Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
In this episode, we get to visit with another speaker here at the Techonomy Climate Event in New York. Laurie Wayburn is a leading authority in forest conservation and sustainability. As the co-founder and president of the Pacific Forest Trust, Laurie has spent decades pioneering market-based approaches to conserve and then sustainably manage some of the most vital forest ecosystems in the world. Laurie, it is so great to be with you today at the Techonomy Conference around Climate Week, I guess day three of Climate Week, and looking forward to our conversation on Path to Zero. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for having natural tech as part of the tech approach and techonomy.
Well, I was thinking about this as we talked a little bit last night in preparation for today. We've had guests generally cover every subject at least twice. I believe you will be the first one that we're really talking about the role of forest and carbon. So I'm looking forward to that. And let's get right to that. You've pioneered this economic model that rewards owners of forests, generally landowners, to manage their lands sustainably, right? Talk to us about what Pacific Forest Trust does and who you work with, and give us a primer on it.
Sure. Forest landowners are people like everybody else. They have a variety of motivations for why they own and manage their forest lands, but a big, big driver for many of them is financial return. So if we look at the fact that the loss and degradation of forests is the second largest source of CO2, excess CO2 in the atmosphere, you want to look at what those financial drivers are for forest landowners to be doing the things that lead to those emissions. So markets pay for development, and they pay for the fastest return on the sale of timber products. Now, our approach in looking at this and at looking at the fact that forests, unlike other emission sectors, can actually reabsorb their emissions, is to look at the financial drivers for why landowners do that, and could we intervene? Could we develop ways to intervene in there to instead pay for them to manage for what we really need as public benefits from forests? So the founding ethos of Pacific Forest Trust was to align the economic and ecologic interests in a new way, such that private landowners could manage for public benefits and do it in a way which was beneficial to their bottom line.
And when you talk about landowners, it could be a corporation, it could be an individual, or anything in between, right?
You're absolutely right. Family forest landowners, corporate forest landowners, they do it all.
And do you rule out a certain species, or like I come from the land of southern yellow pine everywhere. You live in a place where you have no southern yellow pine. You have hardwoods and you have firs. And are there any trees that you prefer not to see, or is there a certain species that you love to see for its carbon retention?
We look at forests for their broad climate benefits, which is inclusive of carbon but not limited to carbon. Other climate benefits are watershed values, extraordinarily valuable in terms of a changing climate, biodiversity, the web of life that supports us. So we work with the focus of natural forest management. In other words, managing for the natural forest that is there. There was a wonderful, wonderful, somewhat funny Forest Service study early on, 30-year study, and it found that Douglas fir grew best where Douglas fir grew naturally. So in the South, you might focus on longleaf pine. If you were in the Mississippi bottomlands, it would be a mixed hardwood forest. In the West, we're managing for mixed conifer and individually dominated, you know, forest types like redwoods, where there's a single tree species that really is dominant. Oak woodlands, where oak woodlands grow. Right. That's what's going to be the most resilient from a climate change and the rich from a carbon perspective.
And you have a solution for all of them. And you know, we've only been in this a couple minutes, but you've used the word managed several times. So most of us, I think, have the vision that a landowner would have a forest in order to be inside your program, it's leave it alone. But it is far from that. It's actively managed, right?
You are absolutely right. We view conservation as an active sport.
And there could even be some selective timbering.
Absolutely. Timber removal is going to be a fundamental part of this approach. So many of our forests have been overplanted. Our notion was if an acre could grow one tree, it should be able to grow 10 trees. But it only grew one tree because that's what the water and light and soils supported. And so when you have overcrowded forest, whether it's in the west or it's in the east or it's in the south, those forests have a huge amount of competition, and it tends to weaken the forest overall, making them more susceptible to drought stress, to heat stress, to these intense precipitation events, to invasive species. Forests are like people. If you are under stress, you're less healthy. And that means you're more susceptible to all of these risks.
And interesting, it's not just about the canopy that we think about, it's about the nutrients, the water, access into the roots. Really, really interesting. What a great passion. You've been doing it for 30 years. Tell us about how you started and what motivated you to be this expert.
I began my career in the United Nations overseas in the field of appropriate and sustainable development. And one of the things that was very compelling was you had many, and still have, many aid agencies that are trying to drive a model that works in their country and to manage the natural resources that are in, for example, Kenya or Chile or somewhere else, the way they manage them in their country. And that has led to a lot of environmental disasters. So the focus for us in the UN in that particular program was to work with the natural system and to derive what was needed from that natural system in the way of food, fiber, clothing, etc. Bringing that back to the United States, where we have this paradigm of all or nothing, wilderness and set-asides, or do whatever you want, the goal was, let's find that happy medium in between. If you will, it's not black or white, it's that whole rainbow. And that's what really inspired me. And working with a number of truly, truly great ecologists, folks like Jerry Franklin, Ray Dasman, they were just very, very inspiring as to, we're smart enough as a species to figure out how this system works and to work within the system because we're part of the system.
You live in California.
Yes.
An area that we really think of a strong environmental culture, but yet a really strong clash, particularly in Northern California, with the logging culture. How do you manage that tension?
Well, 30 years ago, that tension was extremely strong. I'd say we have made a good bit of progress since that time. But that tension came from what we were speaking about a moment ago. Financial return, short-term financial return, and then on the other side, that's the landowner's goal, land manager's goal, that short-term financial return, and on the public side was the only responsible response that they thought was no. And the place in between was really to look at what drives people to do what they do and to figure out how we could compensate forest landowners for the public benefit.
They're beginning to see that.
Yeah. If you approach people not as an enemy,
right,
but as an ally, and forest landowners need to be your allies. We need to be their allies. If we would like them to do something different, we need to understand what's driving them to go where they go and work with them in a different way to get what they need while also protecting those public benefits.
Interesting. You touched on earlier, you started with the United Nations and a really interesting conversation there about advising policymakers all over the globe. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that work.
So I started out in the United Nations Environment Program, and then I went on to work within the somewhat ill-named Man and Biosphere Program, which should be People and Biosphere, but at the time, the other term subsumed everybody else. And the goal there, as I say, was really to find a way to live within our means, if you will, ecologically. because there's a deep recognition that human health is intertwined with planetary health. And so working in different countries to support both the research of understanding those ecosystems and what they produce naturally, and then developing ways to work within that to provide for food, fiber, and so on. So different ways to approach agriculture, promoting organic agriculture and native plants, different ways to work within forests to derive food as well as wood-based supplies. It was really fascinating because it gives you a different appreciation, foundation of indigenous knowledge, because people could not have survived without that knowledge, and porting that into the 20th century and the 21st century. That's a key part of what needs to be done. Obviously, we're not going to be living the way that people have lived for eons because we're too accustomed to everything that is in our daily lives. But there are some very deep lessons there about what plants grow best, how to cultivate those plants, what are the ways to work to retain water, how do you work within the biodiversity that is there and support it. Tremendous amount to be learned.
Laurie, has your model been adopted, anything like that, by other organizations across the country or even more importantly around the world?
Absolutely. The Working Forest Conservation Easement, which is a key legal tool that we use in our work that conserves actively managed lands within them and guides how those are, that's now the national standard for conservation easements on forests. More importantly, one of the key things that we did is we got the change in management to forests included in California's climate policy. And one aspect of that is compliance grade forest carbon offsets. Mm-hmm. That is now part of every single timber company's asset base. They all look at it as an option. So that driver is very widely adopted. Those standards for the compliance system, and I'm not talking about voluntary offsets, but that compliance system set of standards has been broadly utilized throughout the U.S., Canada, globally, at every U.N. conference. This is an area where California talks about those, but every member of RGGI, the Western Climate Initiative, they use those same compliance standards.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, we talk so much about forest and their role here in natural carbon. First off, what problems do you face every day in getting people to understand that message and then act to that?
Well, a critical issue is very few people think of themselves as forest people in the United States. They're urban people, they're rural people, but they don't think of themselves as forest people. I can bet you it's a handful of people who wake up every morning in the U.S. and go, oops, there went another 6,000 acres of U.S. forests lost. So we lose to development of one sort or another about the size of the state of Delaware every year.
Wow.
That's huge. So a key problem that we face is that forests are not in people's minds as a daily issue. People love trees. They don't necessarily know what a forest is. They haven't experienced it.
Can a forest be an acre?
You can have elements of a forest in an acre.
And you can get carbon benefits in 1 acre of trees, can't you?
You can. But think of forests as a broad climate solution. So trees and forests in an urban setting are hugely beneficial for human health, for human well-being, for absorbing carbon, for biodiversity, and for cooling our cities, for managing our water. So you can get huge benefit from forests, even at the very small scale.
I know you and I talked last night, and it was obvious to me, I think of a tree as the canopy, to the point you're talking about the shade, the shape. I guess a logger would look at it for the trunk and what that means to them and board feet. But yet you look at it as a system much broader than the canopy, much broader than the trunk, but the roots down in the soil, the soil around the tree, it's very much a system to you.
It's absolutely a system, and it's a system that has its own forms of communication.
We feel some of them. We may not understand it, but we feel them. For example, you know, being in a forest enhances your immune system. There's an interaction between you and the forest. When most people walk through the forest, they wouldn't think about, oh, I'm helping my immune, I'm healthier as a result. Exercise, it's cooler, it's prettier, but it's actually directly interacting with you. Underneath the soil, there's a whole system of communication and circulation, just like our bodies have circulation. Those roots between trees are exchanging energy, they're exchanging knowledge, they're exchanging all kinds of information in between their roots through the mycelia, and there's that transport of water and minerals. It's quite astounding.
Interesting. And then that system gets upset pretty quickly sometimes by the hurricanes, tornadoes, but the one that comes to mind as I'm talking to you is wildfire. Wildfire comes in and wipes out hundreds of thousands of acres. How do you account for that carbon with your people you're advising? What happens to that carbon?
I love your language. Wildfire comes through and wipes out. It actually doesn't wipe out. Fire is part of our forest systems. Every single forest type in the U.S. is fire adapted, and I dare say virtually every forest type globally is somewhat fire adapted. Even our West Coast temperate rainforests, the redwoods, are fire adapted. They're the so-called frequent fire rainforests. So you think about California, and it's wonderful talking to people in New York. They say, oh, your entire state is on fire. A, it's not. But B, the large majority of those fires are actually beneficial. They're actually beneficial. I'm repeating that. They're actually beneficial. So fire in forests is classed as high intensity, moderate intensity, low intensity. Moderate and low intensity are net beneficial. Hmm. You're reducing the overall fuel load to where more fire can come through in a safe manner. Remembering that these forests are fire adapted, that means the fire is actually contributing fine charcoal to the soil. It's getting rid of pests and diseases. You know, in the same way that we clean a wound with something that's astringent and it stings, but it actually cleans the wound. Fire is one of those kinds of elements. So where it is of high intensity, and even within that high intensity fire, it's quite variegated. It's not the same all across the landscape. You have reservoirs of areas that were not that badly burned from which life will respring, if you will. So we need to change our view of fire. The idea that wildfire is bad is incorrect. It's how we manage fire, not how we stop fire, that really matters. And if we change to fire management rather than fire suppression, we have a healthier, more carbon-rich, and more resilient forest than if we focus on fire suppression.
Interesting. Well, you and I are both today in New York at the Taconomy Climate. We both just walked out of a session where Bill McKibben spoke, I would say, in fairly dire terms about activism, about single solutions. I think you and I both reacted to it differently, but you feel strongly that he left out this whole conversation around nature-based solutions, a solution that you've championed for almost 30 years. Talk to us in the context of maybe his opening, but then even how important nature-based solutions are and why that's critical as we think about the future.
Well, these nature-based solutions are the missing half. It's the yin and yang. We need both.
Right.
And I think part of what has occurred is that historically within this climate action movement, many people have thought of working with nature as an excuse for changing our fossil fuel-based habits. And as such, they didn't realize that, as I say, 42% of the excess CO2 in the atmosphere, of what's driving the system in the wrong way now, comes from the loss and degradation of forests. But in the next 5 to 10 years, what can we most immediately change? It's how we manage forests. Just by extending the average rotation by which we harvest trees, we can reabsorb and absorb hundreds of millions of tons of carbon dioxide in California alone by simply changing a fraction of what we do on a fraction of the privately owned forests, which are the, you know, a little less than half of the forests in the state. So when you look at that, you go, oh my goodness. So the issue here is that, if you will, you want to go from the forest floor to the urban core. And you want to include the ocean shore, absolutely. And change, not stop, but change how we manage these resources to improve the quality of lives in our cities, to lower the temperatures of our cities, to reduce the flooding in our cities, and at the same time, reestablish the connectivity between our cities and our wildlands through changing how we manage our lands. And the biggest single carbon-reducing element of that is changing what we do with forests. America is extraordinarily rich in its natural forest lands. And by reestablishing forests throughout the areas that we've converted, so within, for example, our riparian areas, reestablishing our forests there within these agricultural lands, absolutely keeping our agriculture, but reestablishing forests, we increase our carbon sequestration, we clean out most pollution from our waterways, trees do that for us too, and we create this whole circulatory system for biodiversity. So we address that twinned crisis of climate change and biodiversity loss. Those two things are synergistically linked through working with nature. And Bill's approach on energy and fossil fuels is absolutely correct, but it won't succeed. We simply won't succeed if we do not have these nature-based and forest-based solutions. Because where are you going to get that 42% out of the atmosphere?
Right. Yeah, well said. All right, let's have some fun. I'm going to give you a magic wand. Okay. You can use it for one thing in the next 1 year to have the most beneficial impact on climate change. How would you use that magic wand?
I would have an extraordinarily persuasive marketing and communication system throughout the world that focused on changing our approach to nature as a climate solution. Because if you win people's hearts and minds and they understand that this single trigger is the single most effective solution we can deploy in the next 5 to 10 years, we have a good hope of doing that.
Yeah. Well said. And such a great visual about what why we're doing it. Save the planet, but save that tree. All right, this is almost ironic to ask you this.
Okay.
Because we love to plant a tree in honor of the time you spend with us, in honor of your expertise you've shared with us. And so we usually ask you to give us a national forest in which to plant a tree in your name and your honor. Can you think of such a place?
Well, I'd actually ask you to help conserve an acre next to a national forest. Yes, planting trees is wonderful. I love doing it. But before you think that planting a tree is the one right thing to do, conserve the forest next to that national forest, because we're getting these hard edges between the national forest and development. And these national forests, national parks, don't exist as islands in a landscape. They are part of the landscape. And when you have these hard barriers right next to them, that introduces all kinds of risks, be it fire, pests, invasive species.
Wow.
So I'm going to ask you to help conserve an acre.
We're going to work on that then. That's a great, great choice for us to work on. So thank you very much. Before we leave you, how can people learn more about your work, about Pacific Forest Trust?
They can go to our website, www.pacificforest.org. They can watch a film called Beyond the Trees, which is available on the website, easy to Google, and we would welcome their interest in what we do.
Awesome. Laurie Wayburn, president, co-founder, Pacific Forest Trust, 30 years talking about it, and you leave us at the end of this podcast thinking about the forest and nature-based solutions in an entirely different way. Thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.